You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, August 15th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, to discuss the Trump meltdown and what it means in terms of progressives leveraging Hillary Clinton, the great Digby from the blog Hullabaloo will be joining us. Also on the program, violence for a second night in Milwaukee, the nation's most segregated city. GOP and conservative media weeps and then ultimately blames themselves insofar as liberals made them do it. Meanwhile, new research shows economic anxiety not necessarily a driver for Trump supporters. And the non-Lewandowski, non-Roger Stone Trump campaign manager seems to be in a bit of trouble. Couldn't have happened to a nicer guy. New polls out. Apparently, the young and most states in the country hate Donald Trump. And it's a legitimate question. Will the Department of Justice step all over Donald Trump's plans to have election observers? And the Clinton administration, or I should say campaign, and other government officials across the country respond to the DEA's refusal to reschedule marijuana, Clinton supposedly will. We'll see. Jimmy Reefer Cake, you may want to tune in for that one. Just a bit of house cleaning, ladies and gentlemen. First off, let me just say, last week the show ended rather abruptly, at least the fun half did. And we're going to have Kelly on in the fun half of this program to finish that conversation. Of course, she was going on vacation this week, and so she wanted to have her say at the end of the show, and I had to go pick up my kids, so I had to end the show at 2. And so things ended pretty abruptly. We had an extended conversation that started... wasn't, I think, ultimately about. Maybe it was. I don't know. Well, but started with the excessive use of cuck that we use. And
it's not going away.
The word of cuck. Probably not, no. Would be my guess. But, then continued on in the fun half of the program. So we got more emails in response to that argument than any other except for math. The show on math was the only one that had more response from people and more virulent response from people. Math, people are very sensitive. And the only thing I'd say, I was surprised people didn't work in the math and the conversation that we had with Kelly. That did not happen, which shocked me. Folks, someone said to me the other day, you got to tell Michael. She was critiquing the set. She was critiquing the set. She had watched Michael on a Monday. She's making some critiques about the set. And you got to tell that guy to shave. Now, I didn't. I didn't tell Michael to shave because I always disliked it when my grandmother told me to shave. And so that's my one thing I won't do. I won't tell people to shave. around me. But see that Michael did. He came in today, and the first thing he comes in, I said, look at you, all clean shaven. And he said, I shaved with my...
Harry's.
My Harry's razor. Now, let me ask you, because people know what I love about shaving with my Harry's razor, and that is, I mean, it gives me a good shave. I don't like to shave, and it gives me a better shave than probably any razor I've ever used on any consistent basis. I can't remember. But even more important to someone like me is that it is inexpensive and comes right to my door. Let me ask you, Michael, what is it you love most about? And, you know, it's not love. I mean, it's not real love. It's just you. What do you enjoy best about your Harry's razor?
It's a great shave. I mean, it's simple.
Really
Sorry.
Well said. Really well said. That is
There's not much to add to that,
stuff.
Sam. I can't vamp too much on that. But the price is obviously the best thing. And you know what? Not having to go to Duane Reade and have them unlock the case for me.
That's right. That's and you're like the type of guy who goes in and you shoplift your condoms, right? Because you're too embarrassed to go up
so
front.
I distract them while they're opening the case, and then I slide the condoms in my pocket. Exactly.
Harry's
Good evening
five,
ahead.
Harry's five blade razors now include a softer flex hinge for a more comfortable glide, trimmer blade so you can basically fit the corner. I'm not saying you shave your nose, but that's always a problem area. Now it's a thinner, a trimmer blade. A lubricating strip, a textured handle for more control when it's wet. Still, just $2 a blade compared to $4 or more you'll pay at the drugstore. I can't even believe that. I haven't bought one in a drugstore for probably over 2 years now. The idea of paying $4 for one of those blades is just absurd.
If we did math, we would know how much money we were saving. But I
exactly.
could just say it's a lot, big time.
If you're going to go pay $4 at the drugstore, why don't you just get a haircut every time you want to shave? Seriously. They'll bring out the straight razor. You can spend, I don't know, $35 or $15 or whatever it is you pay for a haircut. By owning the factory in Germany where they make the blades, Harry's can produce high-quality razors themselves, sell them online for half the price. Quality is always 100% guaranteed. If you don't love your shave, Harry's will fully refund you. And now here it is, folks. Harry's Starter is an amazing deal. You get a weighted razor handle of your choice, moisturizing shave cream, 3 precision-engineered 5-blade cartridges, and a travel cover for $15. But it gets better. If you have never purchased from Harry's, you can do so now and get $5 off your first purchase with the promo code MAJORITYREPORT. Go to harrys.com right now. Enter the code MAJORITYREPORT at checkout. Claim your offer. That's harrys.com, code MAJORITYREPORT. All right, we're going to get to a Digby in 1 second, but I want to show you, I don't know if this is more insight into me or insight into what's going on with the Trump campaign.
Both disturbing.
Both disturbing. But this is what made me literally laugh out loud today. All right, this is, Sam, we should have some theme song with this music. Okay, this is Sam's moment where he actually chuckled today. It was from a... an email, you know, I get emails from Washington Post, stuff like that, written by James Homan from the Washington Post. And it's in response to the story of Paul Manafort apparently being on some ledger, secret ledger, handwritten in Ukraine about receiving almost $13 million. So he writes, in any conventional campaign, someone in Manafort's position would not be able to survive a story like this. But this is not a conventional campaign. And then he gives examples of what a broad spectrum of news people are saying, or media people. An editor at Fusion, the site owned by Univision, teased that more damaging stories will come soon. Adam Weinstein writes, speaking as someone who has a story come this week, this is just the beginning for Manafort. It gets worse. A Fox News contributor, Julie Roginski, the fact that Trump has started receiving security briefings and that Manafort may have access to them is not a joke. A Republican strategist in Texas. If Manafort truly cares about Trump, he resigns by 8 a.m. tomorrow. Staff can't be a distraction, and this is a massive distraction. Former speechwriter to George W. Bush. Assuming it's Trump who Manafort ultimately answers, but that's a question now, isn't it? The former director of the Richard Nixon Presidential Library, now a distinguished historian at NYU. How demonstrably Putinist does Manafort have to be for the RNC to insist Trump dump him? And this is the line that made me laugh, written by the author. The imbroglio over Manafort is likely to overshadow the much ballyhooed foreign policy speech that Trump will deliver today. Yeah, I'll say. All right. Well, that is Sam's chuckle of the day. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to the great Digby. All right, we are back on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program the proprietor of the blog Hullabaloo, the columnist for Salon.com, the great Digby, Heather Parton herself. Hello, Digby.
Hey, Sam. How are you doing?
Well, as we said when I got you on the phone, it's quite a Monday. we were in the office and compiling stuff and it's actually one of those Mondays where Trump's chief spokesperson claiming that Barack Obama started the Afghanistan war in 2009 slid down the list of things we got to.
I know. It's amazing. I mean, I actually was trying to compile a list of crazy things that he had said and the campaign had done over the past week. And I finally just kind of, I was trying to write something for Salon, and I just kind of went, oh, my God, forget it. It's just too much. We can't focus. There's just too much. The guy is unbelievable. And it's going to get
worse.
I mean, I can't even imagine what's going to happen today now with this, foreign policy speech, which I think we can expect will be delivered within his usual desultory, bored fashion that he does whenever he has to deliver a prepared speech.
Yeah, this one's going to be written, right? And just sort of, and very sort of, I guess, I don't know, he's going to be pouting the whole way, which means that tomorrow or Wednesday, he goes off the rails again.
Yep. That is the pattern. It's very interesting. I mean, well, we saw an interesting thing happen last week that I was sort of tracking. He gave his economic speech. I mean, it's hard to believe it was only a week ago. He gave his economic speech, and that was clearly kind of, boring to him and to everyone who listened to it, except for the parts where he sort of exclaimed, "Wow, that's good,"
right,
like
exactly.
He'd never read it before. and then afterwards, of course, he went crazy and started talking about, implying that the gun nuts might have to do something, quote, to deal with Hillary Clinton if she wins, if they want to save their gun rights. That caused a big firestorm, at which point then he became, I don't know if you noticed this, but I mean, on Friday, he was downright depressed. I mean, I've never seen him like this before. He was just kind of dully giving these speeches. He gave a speech to the National Home Builders Association down there in Florida, and he had another rally where he was just kind of really phoned it in, and I'm thinking, man, the guy is just depressed. I've never seen this before. And then, of course, on Saturday, the big story in the New York Times came out about the chaos within the campaign and how everybody describes him as having mood swings and agreeing to listen to his advisors and then just going out and doing the opposite, and how everybody involved is intensely frustrating, and they've been having these interventions for really a couple of months now, and it's just not doing any good. And he came out on Saturday night with one of the, you know, most... agitated rallies I've seen him do in Fairfield, Connecticut. And he was really, and it was all about the press. Now, of course, this was in reaction to the New York Times, and he went nuts and was just, I really felt like he'd had, I know he doesn't drink or, you know, drink coffee or do anything. He's, you know, he's kind of a straight edge guy. But I think maybe he had a little too much sugar or something, because he was way, way, way manic.
Wait, didn't he say something? Now that you say that, like, I feel like he said something like, if Florida and Pennsylvania,
yeah,
and Michigan,
I'll never forgive you.
I'll never forgive them. Well, maybe I will.
Yeah.
Like, wait, yeah. This is like a weird. Like
he didn't even say, well, maybe I will. He said, but I'll love you anyway. Great. That's one of the best sales pitches. I mean, this guy's supposed to be a master salesman. He's telling people, I'll never forgive you if you don't buy my product. You know, it's kind of okay. That
works. Very strange. Like, there is that moment really struck me as being particularly odd, because that's just like, there's a certain amount of entitlement there that apparently I don't know. I don't even know how to respond to that, because, you know, a lot of the stuff you see him do makes some sense, right? Like, his whole, I'm not going to say this. I'm not going to say that my opponent is, you know, was a blankety blank. I would never say that. You know, you can see what he's doing. In that situation, I was just like, I really don't get what's going on there. That is a very strange, perspective. But
well, it sounds emotional to me. You know, like personal.
Yeah,
like
sad.
You know, like, you're hurting me. These polls are hurting me. Don't you understand that I'm just a guy, you know, trying to win the presidency here, and you people are letting me down. I mean, it's very strange. But I think that article on Saturday really kind of focused in a way. I mean, it was a great article by, I think, was it Patrick Healy and Maggie Haberman?
Yes.
Anyway, that, you know, the two of them obviously have some great contacts in that campaign. And then the Wall Street Journal also yesterday then kind of verified what the New York Times had said through their own contacts in an editorial that I think came out last night. But what they were saying was that, you know, Trump is like, there's something going on with him. I mean, aside from, you know, I mean, I don't want to be an armchair psychologist, narcissist, blah, blah, you know, sociopath, blah, blah, blah. But there does seem to be a kind of a mood swing thing happening with him. And it apparently he gets, you know, chagrined at the criticism if someone tells him something, and he'll either lash out at them or he gets a little depressed and agrees, yes, I'll pull it together. And then somehow, I don't know, if he goes on his Twitter feed and reads some David Duke tweets or something and gets himself all excited and hepped up again, and he goes out and does this crazy stuff. But he really, really is unable to take advice and run with it. I mean, it's a matter of intent. He can't do it.
I have heard stories, and you know, look, let's face it. When it comes to Trump, we all need to figure out what the hell is going on. And we should put him, but I have heard stories, and you know, it's all secondhand stuff, but from people who knew his bankruptcy attorneys, and they would say, like, okay, we sat down with them, we told them this, look, you have to approach this deposition in this way, in this way, and he signs off on it, and he goes in, and it's just completely out the window, so I mean some of this is not terribly surprising. And I think, like, it's weird. I want to pivot from this, because I think at this point, you know, what is sort of stunning is that we are in mid-August. You know, like, I thought the possibility of getting to this place maybe in, like, late September, early October was possible.
Agreed.
But the idea that this would happen in mid-August, it just seems to me to be, is astonishing, frankly. And what really is... the measure, it seems to me, is that And we've never seen this, Digby. And it ties into something that I think is also sort of problematic in terms of the Clinton campaign, though. But let's start with the media. We have never seen this where the media just feels like, okay, we no longer, the norms, I think like Brian Stetler, who is he's just a media reporter on the media, but the norms are out the window. So like sort of like the media is sort of unshackled here, like where they can actually say like, no, that's not true. You know, something that you've never heard them say, regardless of the lies they're being told, they are now stepping up and saying that's not true in a way, whether it's like chyrons on CNN or reporters saying it to spokespeople. It's fascinating in some respects, isn't it?
Oh, it is fascinating. I've never seen anything like that where, you know, they basically, instead of doing the usual sort of dancing around it, you know, it was misleading or, you know, that wasn't factually accurate or, you know, trying to do the both sides do it, although there is some of that. But, you know, the norm has changed, and thank God for it, because this would be a tremendously dangerous thing. If you were to accept someone who lies this much. In fact, I wrote about this yesterday. I mean, the sheer level of dishonesty that Trump represents. I mean, we don't know whether or not this is coming from his own beliefs or if it's some kind of a strategy. It doesn't matter. The amount of lies, the sheer number of them, much less the fact that they are lies that are so easily checked and so easily debunked, is unprecedented. I mean, it's beyond anything that we've ever seen before, I think, with a major candidate.
Without a doubt. I mean, just even going in and saying something like, you know, if I lose Pennsylvania, it's because Hillary Clinton cheated. I mean, aside from the sort of the very dangerous and horribly irresponsible and et cetera, et cetera. But it's also just a flat out, like, are you serious? Like this is just like a math situation here for you.
Well, yeah. And, you know, I mean, even more blatant ones, like, you know, that global warming is a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese. I mean, you know, he says stuff like that.
But here's the thing, they're treating lies like that as if they are unique, but a massive segment of the Republican Party has been saying the identical thing, and they don't have the same on global warming. They don't have the press has like a special get out of jail free card as far as they're concerned when it comes to Trump. I mean, that's the wrong construct, because in some way it's like, respond like a human being card. But it's just good for Trump. Like this whole thing where Trump is sui generis. Well, I've heard that word more times now in the past, like 2-3 months in terms of Trump. I think that's problematic. And weirdly, it's something that I think is being promoted, or at least not pushed back upon, by the Clinton campaign. I mean, Corey Robin wrote something that Carl Behart. There was one email from the in the DNC hack that talked about the frustration that some of the people at the DNC had with Clinton, basically telling them, like, you know, we want to drive a cleave between Trump and the GOP and not sort of tie him to them. Now, I mean, I just want to get your take on it, because I think there's some, I can understand some electoral strategy about it, but if that is the case, then that strategy better pivot now, right? I mean, it seems to me, like, but give me your take on it first.
Well, yeah, I mean, I too have felt the same kind. I mean, I can't say that I feel, you know, frustrated by it, more a little bit wary. And it's because I do think that it has been the strategy. And I am not going to sit here and say that is not a good strategy from a presidential campaign point of view, because
All right.
It has, you know, there was an opening here for moderate suburban, particularly white college-educated women in this campaign for the Democrats, and not just Hillary Clinton, but for all Democrats, to finally, it's been a long road, I think you and I have talked about this before, that that particular group, and white college-educated men as well, have always been Republican. I mean, going back to the beginning of polling, they've always voted majority Republican. But slowly but surely over the years, they've been coming over to the Democrats. And I think that the Clinton campaign, whether they're doing this for their own purposes or not, the idea is that these people may become Democrats. You know, we've seen that happen in the past where Democrats became Republicans, you know, in Ronald Reagan's, you know, famous 1980 Reagan Democrat election and whatever. And I think that this that Democrats may see this as a tipping point. In other words, to finally get this particular group into the Democratic fold, and which makes sort of makes sense. I mean, in terms of what we're seeing with politics at the moment. So I can understand it, and I, you know, and I'm hopeful that they may actually make some progress with that, although that does present a whole set of new issues for the Democratic Party.
Indeed. Are you there? I feel like we just lost it for some reason again. All right, well, give us 1 second. Play some music, if you would. Thought we had this corrected. She's not going to get, you were going to say she was not going to get...
Yeah, I don't think it's not logical in the current political environment to think that a landslide in modern terms would be something like what happened with you know, Reagan and Mondale with 49 states, for instance. I mean, those kind of things just don't happen anymore because of the polarization, but... It is theoretically possible anyway that she's going to get a big win because of Trump. And if that's the case, then it's vitally important that she come out of this with some kind of a mandate on policy. And I kind of differ a little bit, I think, with Corey and some others who are worried, or Robert Reich, for instance, who are really worried that she's not going to fulfill her mandate, because really she is running on that very progressive platform that
right.
was hammered out at the DNC. So I think it's a little unfair to say that she's, you know, she hasn't said anything on policy in terms of trying to woo Republicans, at least not yet. So I'm not ready to condemn her for that. But she does need to tie Donald Trump and the Republican Party together so that she can get a, you know, try at least to get a majority in the Congress, or at least humiliate the Republicans to a degree that at least, you know, maybe Paul Ryan is, you know, drawn to the middle in some way and can work with Democrats. I mean, I don't hold out any great hope for that, but it's possible anyway. But if she just does this, you know, it's just Trump, then that's not going to happen, because that'll allow all these other guys to separate themselves from him and say, hey, well, you know, I'm okay. I'm not like him. And that's not going to work for her, I don't think. So I agree with you. I think that it's really important that the campaign start to make a case against Republicanism as Trumpism. You know what I mean? I mean,
definitely.
It's true. It's not like Trump. You know, I mean, this is an interesting little known fact, I think, among people. When Trump decided to run for president, yeah, this was actually back in 2011. He's been planning this for a long time. It didn't just come out of the blue. And you remember he was talking it up. Of course, he's talked it up in the past before that. But he was serious in 2011. And he hired this guy. In fact, there was a lawsuit that was just settled with this guy, you know, typical Trump. I think his name is Sam Nunberg. And he, his job was to listen to right-wing radio and give a, you know, a report to Trump every day on what people were talking about. Trump didn't, I mean, there are certain things that Trump has believed his whole life. I mean, one is, you know, the rest of the world is laughing at America, our trade deals are terrible, and we need law and order. We got to keep the people, you know,
right.
in line. The police don't have enough. That's really about it. I mean, the guy doesn't. that's the end of his consistent philosophy. That's just, you know, white nationalism, basically. But on all this other stuff, including immigration, he got this from talk radio. This is where it comes from. This was where he got the idea to do, and you know, he read Ann Coulter's book, you know, Adios America. He's done this, and he went to Liberty University and talked to Jerry Falwell Jr. And he, you know, he put all this together. I mean, he's nuts, but you know, he's not without some skill in sensing the right-wing zeitgeist, obviously. And he got this from the right wing. So it is Republicanism. This is the Tea Party. It's the right wing. They've been there since the 1990s, as we know, the talk radio right. And, you know, it's totally fair to tie him to that because that's where he got it. I mean, it's not like this came out of, you know, just Trump came out of nowhere and suddenly started talking about this stuff.
And the bottom line is, he is the Republican nominee. It wasn't just like, you know, I mean, I keep saying this over and over again, but it wasn't like, you know, he was on the deck of the Starship Enterprise and, you know, Jim Kirk and the gang had to go back to 2016 and they just beamed him in. No, he won the plurality of votes in the nomination process.
And look at the other candidates in that primary. Look what they were saying. I mean, there were a few who were kind of saying, hey, you know, we're not really with you there. But they
in
got
a couple
no
of
votes.
Narrow instances. I mean,
yeah,
on policy,
I mean,
there wasn't like huge gaps in daylight.
No, I mean, look at Marco Rubio. He moved so far out on the right, he fell off the edge, and he seemed pretty comfortable doing it. I didn't get a sense that he didn't want to. Ted Cruz was the runner-up. I mean, Ted Cruz was the runner-up. So, I mean, that's all you really have to know. That is the Republican Party, and it's not just the plurality that voted for Trump. It's the vast majority who voted for an entire, you know, clown car full of right-wingers. I mean, there was Kasich, who, you know, by the way, he's one, too.
Yes,
but
exactly.
It's just by comparison that he looks like some kind of a moderate. Jeb Bush was like from another, he was beamed in from another era. And the rest of them, I mean, Chris Christie, I mean, these people, they sounded like, you know, they were, it was a mob of right-wing freaks that were running, and Trump just happened to be the most entertaining of all of them.
Well, I mean, this is what has been frustrating me. I am not as concerned with the notion that somehow if Clinton attracts a certain amount of white Republican suburban voters that it's going to inhibit. I mean, because they have to realize that, like, you know, I mean, this cuts both ways, right? If Trump is so unique, then there's going to be a real problem in 2020. I mean, I happen to think that any Republican would have lost in this situation. That's what I thought a year ago, and I still think it. But, I mean, from a progressive standpoint, I think there is some value in saying, like, maybe if it was Jeb Bush, as ridiculous as it is, maybe Clinton would have some greater problems. The point being that, like, you know, I think the one lesson that I think is so clear from all this is, like, we don't know what Donald Trump cares about, and nobody, frankly, who cares? Nobody should care. What's relevant is the 60, 70, 80, 90 million people, 95 million people, 100 million people who could end up voting for him. And that's his base of support. And they're going to, when they vote for him, it's not like they're not going to know why they voted for him.
Yeah.
And so that's what's really problematic. And if there is going to be some type of realignment, it's not going to be because Clinton has wooed a sector of people who are so concerned about Donald Trump. It's going to be because she has fundamentally made the case against that which has given us Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And that's not happening. And it's allowing the press to also not do that in some way. I mean, you know, because I have no expectations that the press are going to do anything that isn't completely left on, a spoon fed to them and gives them any type of out. But it seems to me, and to be fair, you know, even like 3 months ago, I'm not sure you could have predicted like it was going to be this. Like there would be this much slack, you know what I mean?
Oh my God! That I didn't think there would be
talking about Georgia, and you know, I mean, so. But I hope there is a pivot, and so then the question becomes: well, and before we even tack there, I mean, let's talk about one more thing. You mentioned talk radio, and I found this really fascinating. It was a tweet from this guy Oliver Darcy. I guess he's writing a piece at Business Insider where he interviewed that guy Charlie Sykes, who is. I don't know if it's the case or not, but he's certainly credited with a large part of the reason why Donald Trump lost Wisconsin in the primary. is because this guy is a right-wing talker who was out there who's very anti-Trump. Let me just read a quote. I know you've read this, but I want to read a quote just for people. He said in this piece, you know, we've basically eliminated any of the referees, the gatekeepers. There's nobody. And he's talking about nobody to say, to like sort of adjudicate whether or not Donald Trump is lying to the people that Charlie Sykes speaks to. Like, you know, the rest of the normal world knows it, but he's saying how the Republican Party and the conservative movement has been taken over. And he goes, when this is all over, we have to go back. There's got to be a reckoning on this. We created this monster. All conservative hosts, he's talking about talk show hosts, have basically established their brand as being contrasted to the mainstream media. So we've spent 20 years demonizing the liberal mainstream media. And by the way, a lot of it's been justifiable. There is real bias, but at a certain point, you wake up and realize you've destroyed the credibility of any credible outlet out there. And I've got to look in the mirror and ask myself, to what extent did I contribute? I'll be honest. The bias of the mainstream media has been a staple for every conservative talk show host, every conservative pundit for as long as I can remember. What's amazing to me about this quote, it's not that he has this revelation that he created this monster, but he still thinks it's justified. Like, he's still saying, like, they actually were really biased.
I know. Well, you know, I don't think they can let go of that trope, although I give Sykes some credit here for at least getting that far with it. Although we've heard little bits of that. Remember Trent Lott back in, I can't remember when it was, somewhere back in the mid-2000s, where he said, yeah, we've got a problem with talk radio and we're going to have to do something about that.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, every once in a while they get this, a little light goes off and they go, hey, maybe this isn't really working for us quite the way we want it to. But nonetheless, I give the guy credit, and it's getting a lot of circulation, so I think that that's actually a good thing. Particularly, do yourself a favor and go look at Rush Limbaugh's website today when you get a chance to see what he's saying, which is media bias is what's fueling Trump's problems. Period. No, you know, there is nothing but a bunch of liberal media, drive-by media, he calls it. They are making this happen. Trump is not in, he wouldn't be in trouble if it weren't for that. And that is echoed by the Richard Viguerie people, the whole conservative movement. So, you know, it'll be, you know, there's something that I have to admit, there's something weird about Wisconsin in that they actually seem to have rebelled against Trump in a way. Their media there, although Steve Deese in Iowa did too. Some of these media people actually did seem to see the threat of Trump to their own thing.
Well, also a slightly different, I think, probably cash flow. I mean, I bet you, if you were to look at Charlie Sykes' ad inventory, the amount of money that flows in there from some type of Coke-associated things. I'm not saying that's why he says it. I think he just knows where his bread is buttered. And frankly, that's where he gets his funding. I mean, there's a little bit of Coke and Pepsi going on here, but it's the same sort of like cola industry on some level. I mean, you know, the thing, I read this thing from Sykes and all I remember is, what's his face from is it Illinois whose son was gay? And he realized, like, I got to be for marriage equality now.
Right. And, exactly. You know, exactly. Like, that's what they do. Pete Domenici, I remember from the senator, he had a relative who had a mental illness, and he became a big advocate for mental illness.
Right, yeah.
You know, this is what they do.
Yeah.
You know? If it hits them personally, then it's an issue.
I think it's Portman from Ohio, and maybe it was his daughter, but I can't remember. But that's the point there.
Exactly.
And of course, they're just going to revert back, right? I mean, you know, and if you take out Trump's whole candidate, if you take out the media is out to get me out of Trump and, frankly, any of the conservative sort of like, I think, icons in this country. If you take that out with Trump, all that's left is the anti-PC and, you know, a bad hairpiece or whatever it is that's on his head. And I'm sure Sykes has no problem with the anti-PC part of the equation either. I mean, so, you know, I guess what I am concerned about is there's a certain amount of letting them off the hook, which is going to come back around. Like, you don't get these type of opportunities very often, where particularly the media seems to sort of like, you know, I don't want to put the media in a position of going like, well, it's unfair to roll Paul Ryan in with Donald Trump. But you know what? I mean, Paul Ryan has a very easy way to get out from under this, and that is to step away from Donald Trump, which, of course, he won't do because that's who the Republican Party is. And he is out there saving his own skin. He's not doing this because he thinks it's like, I've got to be loyal to Donald Trump. I took a vow or something. It's just he knows his voters are the same people. And if not his voters, I should say, his caucus, which is his main constituency as the Speaker of the House.
Well, exactly. And that's what you want to take away from him. I mean, let's assume, you know, in a perfect world, the Democrats would win the House back. It's a very, very, very tough road for that. I mean, just because of the gerrymandering and the way that we've polarized, it's not totally impossible. It could happen, but it is not something that you can necessarily count on, even if she has coattails and even if she wins with a big margin. But what you could do theoretically is you know, at least split the Republican coalition in this way, where that, you know, these people, this you know, right-wing Freedom Caucus that has really been the big you know, the big thing that sort of gummed up the works over the past few years, and really is the thing that keeps Paul Ryan in Donald Trump's corner. You could theoretically tie them to Donald Trump with no problem, and tie, you know, the other side to Donald Trump with no problem, and let them fight that out themselves. That would be useful because it would put, you know, it would make Paul Ryan kind of, you know, he would be stretched in a number of different directions on that. They need to find some way to prepare for the idea that Clinton is going to have to govern. It's going to be hard enough because I think what you have just described, there's going to be a boomerang effect here. The media is going to feel tremendous pressure and a kind of a discomfort with what's happened with Trump, especially if the Rush Limbaughs blame it all on them. And so they're going to boomerang hard into Clinton. I don't think there's any doubt that it's going to be a miserable, miserable time, 4 years with her. So she has to find some way to govern the country if she wins, and there's no way she can do it if the Republican Party stays the way it is now. That is not going to help her at all. I mean, that is like, yeah, I mean, we're looking at a recipe for even worse gridlock than we've seen under Obama. And I think I think there's a serious danger of that. And I think it's also, as you say, a missed opportunity because this is, you know, only once in a while does that something this, you know, just the opening come along and where everything that's structural that we expect in an election, there's a possibility of upending that. You just don't get that very often, and it would be a shame to waste that. And since I think she's actually, you know, we're not talking about policy anymore, and that's much to the chagrin of a lot of people who think that she won't have a mandate because of that. I actually don't think that's true. I think you have a mandate if you claim a mandate. I mean, if George W. Bush could claim a mandate after,
right, there's no such thing. I don't think there's a mandate one way or another. I mean, if anybody in modern history had a mandate, it would have been Barack Obama, right?
Yeah, and of course he didn't. And we know what happened.
Right, and yeah. I mean, so, and I have to say, you know, the economic speech she gave the other day, there's no sort of like broader ideological realignment type of language, but from a policy to policy standpoint, like, you know, it's moving in the right direction by far. I don't know how much of that's going to get done. I mean, here's the interesting thing, and I think that I hope the Clinton campaign knows this, but I mean, I remember in 2009. In September of 2009, there was a little bit of talk on the, you know, whatever we want to call the left, that there was something wrong with Obama. Like he was beginning to disappoint a little bit. And I remember this distinctly because it was around the bankruptcy bill. He didn't fight for the cram down. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think folks like you and I were complaining a bit. And I seem to remember Bill Maher saying, you know, I'm donating $1 million. So maybe he didn't do it at that time, but he certainly was complaining about the left complaining about Obama. And this is 9 months into his term when the first cracks start to happen a little bit. And then, you know, there was much more of that. But I think that, and so, you know, you could say there was no really concerted criticism for at least a year out, and a lot of those outside organizations had been defanged by design by the Obama campaign in the summer of 2008 by telling, you know, donors, like, no money to outside groups. We're doing this. It seems to me that Clinton is not going to have that breathing room. That it's like going to be like on January 27th, you know, maybe 5 or 6 days, you're going to start to see like the left saying, okay,
let's see what you got.
Let's see what you got. And I got to imagine they're aware of that on some level.
I think they must be. I mean, there are a number of reasons for that. Some of it's the boomerang effect. I think that you and I, this was also a contentious primary on an ideological basis, which is different. She doesn't have the kind of affection on the left that Obama had, regardless of his policies. People very much liked him and wanted to give him a chance. And also, we were in the midst of an epic financial crisis. So a lot of people were willing to go, okay, well, I'll shut up for a while. I wasn't one of them. I was very, very, very concerned about the grand bargain and wrote a lot at the time, from the time in the transition before he even took office, when they were talking this up, very concerned that was going to be, the sort of basis for his economic, you know, negotiations going forward.
You were total emo prog, Digby.
I was an emo prog beyond emo progs. I mean, I really took some heat for that.
You were like a fire bagger.
Oh, yeah. Well, not that, but close.
Right.
I think, I'm a believer in the left keeping the heat on. I mean, I think that's a good idea. I think it helped Obama in the long run. I think that it took them a long time, but I think that, you know, once they got into it and realized that there was, you know, that there wasn't a big margin in trying to court Republicans on policy, that they learned their lesson. I mean, we know that. You and I have talked about the Dan Pfeiffer interview,
yep,
you know, many times. So I think, you know, I think that's okay. You know, I'm not even going to worry about it. I mean, I don't think presidents really have honeymoons anymore. I think that the idea that we all sit around and sing Kumbaya afterwards and hold hands, you know, this isn't about that. This is about trying to, use whatever leverage that you have to try and, you know, keep whoever is in office from doing their worst and prod them from the other side into doing their best. And, you know, it's okay if the left does that, and, you know, I'm not gonna argue with them. Having said that, I don't know, unless she has the majority in Congress, I don't know how these dynamics are going to change enough to actually make that difference, which is why she's looking at, and I read a very interesting article the other day about her plans to use executive power on climate change. Now, you know, I mean, we all have our issues with executive power, particularly in foreign policy and national security. I mean, very, very scary stuff. This is one area where I'm saying, you know, become a dictator. I don't care. You know, if you have to be a dictator on climate change, go for it, because that is one we can't afford to wait any longer. So I'm at least slightly enthusiastic that if she has that in mind, understanding what she's up against and understands the urgency of that particular issue, then I'm not going to prod her. You know, I'm not going to, you know, call her a sellout if she's doing that, or I'm not going to get upset with her using executive power on that particular issue. I mean, national security is another issue, of course.
It's going to be interesting, because I think that, I think the tests are going to come in terms of, like, what are you doing proactively? But I think they're also going to come in terms of, like, what are you renominating Merrick Garland, I think, would be very problematic from her perspective. But, you know, so I could see why she would want maybe just nominate him, you know, not, you know, get have those hearings started before I get into office. But I think the Republicans are not going to give, any type of ground to Barack Obama and validate his presidency. I mean, they want him to go out the door without having done that, I think. I mean, it's going to be moments like that, I think, that are going to be definitional. But we are getting a little ahead of ourselves.
Yeah, we are.
But,
we are.
But hopefully things will just get worse and worse for Trump. And what we won't see, again, I mean, I think this is the dynamic. I think people would be very, very upset if they started to hear her pivot in her rhetoric, because there's no need to, right? I mean, there's even less need to. And in some level, you know, it's like, I don't know, it's fascinating, you know, because if she is the sort of triangulator, she is a, you know, the sort of like just going to be politically expedient, in my mind, like, that's good, because the calculations are in our favor in this day and age. They weren't in 1993. I mean,
that's exactly right. What a great insight. I think that's absolutely true.
And so I hope she is that person, frankly, because I don't care how she is as a human being. I mean, that's, you know, that's her business. I just
it's
want
unknowable.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And I mean, what's interesting, let's just lastly, is this whole, you know, sort of dual between her and Obama on foreign policy, on TPP. She comes out with a speech last week. I'm not in favor of TPP now, not once I get elected, and not once I'm in office. Okay, so she doesn't like explicitly say don't bring it up in the lame duck, but she's certainly implying it. And then Obama comes out the next day with basically announcing, we're going to vote, or we're going to push for a vote on TPP in the lame duck. It's going to be fascinating to see what happens here, because there's about 25 to 30, I think, Democrats who voted for the fast track authority, and they're all going to have to vote for the TPP. And it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, right? I mean, and there's no way of knowing how hard she's going to sort of, I guess, fight against that.
No, and I don't think we'll actually know. I mean, there will be people on both sides, you know, exerting pressure and feeding information to the press. And, you know, there will be a lot of, we've seen this before, like in the healthcare debates, where you've got people feeding different, you know, lines to various players to indicate, oh, she's selling us out, or, you know, she's with us and she's, you know, or she's laying out, you know, whatever it is. I feel for her on this one. I actually do, because I don't know what she thinks about the TPP. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, there's geopolitical considerations. There's all kinds of things going on there. But I do know that she understands how much she owes Barack Obama, and how important it is that she preserve his legacy. He's got his approval rating is going up, up, up at the moment, and the Democratic Party loves him with every fiber of their being. I mean, it is a rare few Democrats. It's a very small minority, even among progressives, who don't love Barack Obama. And she, you know, there may very well be a feeling there that she owes him this, because for whatever reason, he has really decided that this one is important to him. I don't know why. And so she's kind of stuck in this way. So we'll see. They are human beings, right? You know, and it's kind of like, it's sort of like, I owe him big. He's, you know, he's very popular. What do I do here? So, you know, now we're in this situation where we're going to be watching her every move and reading all kinds of intentions in there that I don't even know if we'll actually understand what goes on. But my suspicion is that I think the Republicans are now going to be the ones who, you know, who step up to stop it.
I've always thought that it's going to go down because there's not going to be enough Republicans there.
Yeah.
But certainly, I mean, like, to the point where if you were to peel off 10 out of those 30 Democrats, forget it. Game over. I mean, and it may very well be her statements are enough for a couple of those Democrats to be leveraged by, you know, groups like Credo and PCCC. Like, how can you go against the nominee, right?
Yeah, like, I mean, that's an interesting approach. I would hope that those groups like Credo and TPP would actually do that, because that would be an interesting way to do it. Kind of, look, you know, this is our new president. How dare you?
You're going to hobble her going in?
Yeah.
You know, I think that's a, because it
that's
will.
Because
away. I'll tell you, I think the anger will be huge. And even if it's not, even if she's not responsible for it, which,
right,
you know, I don't know how you dole out these, but it certainly will she will feel the backlash. That's for sure.
Yes, she will. Yes, she will. So, you know, maybe, you know, it would be wise for her to, well, like I said, she's caught between a rock and a hard place on this one. So perhaps the smart thing would be for the left organizations to kind of figure out a way to finesse it. I mean, if what they care about is actually not passing the TPP, then, you know, using that leverage seems to me to be a smart way to go about it. You know, don't make her look bad, you know, going into the thing. Let's try and back up our nominee. I mean, I know that will stick in their craw, but it's, you know, we're supposed to be sophisticated people trying
Indeed.
To actually, you know, actually pass legislation and enact policy. So,
well, with that said, we've got to move on to the part of the show where we talk about poopy pants Donald Trump. And so
I can't wait.
Digby, as always, a real pleasure. Thanks so much for
your time
today.
For having me, Sam. It was fun.
All right. We're going to take a quick break, ladies and gentlemen. And I will remind you that it is your membership that makes it possible. I don't know what it is. I don't know if there's something seasonal that's going on here or what. But and I get it. I get overly responsive to these things. So I've got to just, you know, take a lesson from the Republican nominee. Just go with the flow a little bit. Don't get so caught up. I'm just going to up my Adderall. And
I think that's generally a good idea for you, even in the best of times.
I got to just start taking it. Then I up it.
That's the smartest thing you've said.
Folks, you can become a member today by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Sign up. It's spare change a day to support this program that we try and bring you different perspectives or from different people and different perspectives from people that you may be aware of and, you know, smart conversation. We've got some really great pre-tapes that it's refreshing on some level to not have stuff that is sort of tied into the election. The election seems so all consuming. But those will happen the next week. We're going to head into the fun half. Remember, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Oh, the other thing, Matt, you've been bad.
Not good.
There's some people who are saying that the whole cuckgate that we had yesterday or Friday, which Kelly's going to be joining us in about 5 minutes on the other side, cuckgate was just a false flag to cover your ass, Matt, for leaving La Poupée in the member show. And just because it was a new version, I don't know if you saw the emails, at least like a half dozen emails of outrage, even though it was a new version.
Matt, I apologize, but Matt did approach me on Friday outside of the office, and he said, oh, I've got some things in mind for the show today. And it was very sinister.
And neither confirm nor deny.
Exactly.
Well, all right, so I promise you, if you're a member, you will not hear La Poupée, regardless of what version it is.
Nixon is seeping into your psyche, Matt.
It's crazy what's going on over near that board. Okay, wait a second. Don't do it now. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, the least you can do is use our link at MajorityReportKickback.com. Jet.com is not owned by Walmart yet. And I guess, I don't know. It's the bash between Walmart or, you know, Amazon. You decide. Either way, go to MajorityReportKickback.com. You can skim off the top from both of them. It's just pennies, but if enough people buy, if 100 people buy stuff, you do the math. If it's like 3 pennies, that's 300 pennies. So there it is. All right, folks. 646-257-3920. I'll turn on the IM. We'll be talking to Kelly in just a moment.